conservation organizations and just individual volunteers have just said, we think this is a good program, we should get it back.
Collecting signatures to reestablish the Coastal Management Program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Renda gets ready for the trip to Nome.
There's no ice in the Bering Sea at this time that's beyond the capabilities of the Renda, or even really close to the maximum capabilities of the Renda.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Learn more by participating in one of their informational teleconferences to be held in January. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Backers of a citizens' initiative to reestablish the Alaska Coastal Management Program have unleashed a full-court press to collect nearly 26,000 signatures needed to put the measure on this year's statewide ballot. Juneau Mayor and initiative sponsor Bruce Botello got into the act at the Alaskan and Proud supermarket Tuesday afternoon. He says volunteers are mobilized in nearly every corner of the state.
We're, of course, trying to collect the required signatures before the legislature convenes so that we have a chance to have the 2012 legislature deal with the issue and, absent that, be able to have it on the ballot in August.
Initiative sponsors are operating under the Alaska Sea Party moniker. Statewide numbers were not available, but as of Tuesday, the group had collected about 10,000 signatures in Anchorage and 1,100 in Fairbanks, according to Botello. He didn't have a count for Juneau, but said interest has been strong. Many of the petition gatherers, like Botello, are local government officials, but he says other groups have stepped forward as well.
Some Alaska Native organizations, fishing organizations, conservation organizations, and just individual volunteers have just said, we think this is a good program and we should get it back.
The Alaska Coastal Management Program provided one-stop state and federal permit coordination for developers seeking to build along Alaska's coastline. It closed in July after lawmakers failed to reach a deal to reauthorize it last legislative session. The Parnell administration and House Republicans fought efforts to give local communities more of a voice in the program. The Russian tanker Renda loaded gasoline this afternoon in Dutch Harbor following the completion of its port state control exam. The Renda is set to depart late tonight for Nome. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Sitnisog Board Chair Jason Evans says completing the Renda's payload cleaned out almost the entire inventory of Delta Western's gas in Dutch Harbor.
Somewhere around 300,000 gallons, so we won't take on as much as we hope to completely top off the Renda, but I think it'll be a fairly significant amount that will allow us enough inventories for the community.
Evans says the 300,000 gallons should be enough until the summer barge season. Delta Western is the only vendor in Dutch Harbor with adequate gas to sell. Delta Western is the company that was originally contracted to deliver fuel by barge this fall. That order was canceled after it failed to arrive, and Sitnisog initiated the operation with the Renda. When Sitnisog was exploring options to fly in fuel, they were calling on Delta to, quote, pay their fair share and absorb the extra cost of flying in fuel. But Evans says in this operation, the immediacy of the mission came first.
From my perspective, we've kind of set aside the big picture issues that we'll have to work out with Delta Western in trying to tackle the immediate concern of getting adequate fuel in the Nome. And I think that, you know, from a big picture standpoint, that will take some more time to figure out.
The Renda is expected to depart around midnight tonight for the 800-mile trip to Nome. Vitus Marine CEO Mark Smith says the icebreaker Healy may leave tomorrow morning.
The Healy can travel so much faster than the Renda can that the Healy can, you know, essentially leave Dutch Harbor whenever it wants to and still meet the Renda at the ice edge.
The majority of the ice at sea is between 12 and 24 inches thick. Kathleen Cole, the sea ice program leader for the National Weather Service in Alaska, says the vessels should not face too many obstacles en route.
When the Renda reaches thicker ice, it just slows it down. There's no ice in the Bering Sea at this time that's beyond the capabilities of the Renda, or even really close to the maximum capabilities of the Renda. So it will slow the ship down a little bit, but they'll be able to go through it.
The vessels could arrive in Nome sometime around Sunday, depending on their progress through the ice. What happens at Nome is still not finalized, however. The ice conditions at the final stretch and a ruling by the Department of Environmental Conservation could determine the method of offloading fuel. The Renda may pull into dock and connect, or moor further back on the ice and connect to the headers with hose run across the ice. The accelerated process for the approval of those delivery plans is moving to the next phase now. The public comment period closed at 5 p.m. today for the operation's oil spill prevention and contingency plan. The DEC will be reviewing comments and conducting additional research as necessary to comply with state law. John Catula is the manager of the Marine Vessels section for the DEC. He says the agency can issue a decision with special conditions for the methods and equipment of delivery.
Those conditions of approval can be used to make sure that we get the things in place that it takes to be in full compliance with state regulations and make sure that all spill prevention and response initiatives are in place.
Catula says he expects a decision on the plans within a couple days. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
New Year's Day brought the first death of a client at Anchorage's Carlick Manor Alcoholic Housing Facility. Carlick Manor is operated by the nonprofit Rural Cap and allows its chronic alcoholic clients to drink in their rooms. Reports are that a 54-year-old man, John Court, was found unresponsive during regular checks by employees. Anchorage Police Spokeswoman Marlene Lammers says police were told Court had passed out and appeared to be intoxicated. Lammer said an autopsy would determine the exact cause of death. Melinda Freeman, Rural Cap's Director of Supportive Housing, says if Court had to die, at least he died with dignity and was in a safe place.
John Court passed away on January 1st at 11:30 in the morning in his apartment. He'd lived at Carlick Manor for 3 weeks. He had been homeless for approximately 20 years, the last 10 years in Anchorage. And in addition to his chronic alcoholism, he had multiple medical conditions, and he was in very fragile health. But we were very grateful that he passed away in a caring and compassionate environment.
Carlick Manor opened on December 8th. The Housing First program is based on a model that allows clients to drink in their rooms in the hopes that a safe place will help spur recovery. Carlick Manor is operated with federal funds through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. The project caused controversy in the city, with critics concerned that it would draw more homeless alcoholics to the city's Fairview neighborhood. Supporters of Carlick Manor said the project would help reduce arrests of and emergency room visits by the city's homeless population. Freeman said Carlick Manor operators realized there would be deaths at the facility. Most of the clients lived on the street for years before moving to the shelter. Freeman declined to comment on whether or not the death would affect changes at Carlick Manor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, life as a reality TV star in Alaska.
They would ask us to say things, and I just told them I wasn't getting paid as an actor, and I wouldn't do it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
You've heard of neighborhood zoning. Now there's a move afoot to zone the ocean. Oregon, Washington State, and the federal government all have fledgling plans to coordinate competing ocean uses. But wave energy developers say Oregon's initial draft leaves them in a watery ghetto. Oregon is the first to produce detailed ocean maps. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi was one of the first reporters to get a look and has this report.
At first glance, the Pacific Ocean looks wide open and mostly empty. It's anything but on a digital map the state of Oregon has recently put online. The interactive display includes around 150 layers of data about existing ocean uses and natural features.
Okie doke.
Oregon Sea Grant fellow Todd Hollenbeck demonstrates on his laptop by highlighting prime fishing grounds.
And as you can see now, there's a large area of the territorial sea that's important to fishing, and with really the darker red colors representing some of the most important areas for each of the ports.
The map lights up from Nea Bay, Washington, to the Oregon-California border.
We can turn on things like commercial shipping lanes.
That adds purple lines crisscrossing the screen.
We can turn on some of the seabird layers that represent areas where there are seabird colonies, and these are represented by these little dots that show up right along the shoreline and some of the offshore rocky reef areas.
There are a lot of them.
There's a lot of seabirds.
Okay. And after we put all these layers on, and that's we just selected some of the big ones, what's left if I'm a wave energy developer?
Well, there are not a ton of areas that seem to not have something of importance in them already. And so the challenge here is finding the few areas that do exist that have the least amount of conflict.
That's the nub for actual project developers. Justin Kluwer of Pacific Energy Ventures feels boxed out by the initial set of lines drawn on the ocean planning map.
First blush, that those maps look a little intimidating from the industry perspective, only because the areas that they've identified are relatively small and don't align, I think, with some of the basic requirements that the industry's looking at, which is, you know, access to port, access to transmission, certain water depths.
Kluwer isn't giving up hope yet. It's early in the process, too early, in his view, to be drawing lines in the sand. To stay with the zoning analogy, he argues for a mixed-use approach while more data is gathered. The planning process is moving slowly. That's creating regulatory uncertainty. It scared off at least one ocean energy company interested in Oregon. Europe-based Aquamarine Power closed its local office this fall. In a statement, the company expressed a hope to return to the Pacific Northwest someday, but said it will focus on California in the meantime. Groups representing the fishing fleet remain leery of the ocean planning process. Ilwaco, Washington crab fisherman Dale Beasley has a hard time imagining sharing the sea with industrial energy installations.
Ocean energy and fishing are mutually exclusive. They will not be able to coexist in the same area.
A representative of environmental groups is more conciliatory. Susan Allen directs a coalition called Our Ocean.
I do think that there is a way through this, and it has to do with the fact that Oregon is uniquely suited to deal with this. We have a long legacy of figuring out what compromises are. We are the state that pioneered the Beach Act. We pioneered land use planning.
The ocean mapping and zoning process won't stop the West Coast's first commercial wave energy park. Ocean Power Technologies demonstration project near Reedsport, Oregon, is grandfathered in. The company plans to launch the first of 10 massive floating wave energy generators around the middle of next year. I'm Tom Bonsi in Astoria, Oregon.
The Alaska legislature is scheduled to go back into session on January 17th, but in advance of that date, lawmakers are starting to reveal some of the bills that will be introduced. One of the bills would give employers who hire a veteran a large tax credit. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
America's veterans face many challenges, including finding and keeping a job. Recent data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that last year there were over 1 million U.S. veterans that were officially classified as unemployed. That same data shows that the unemployment rate for post-9/11 veterans was 13.3%. The new legislation, which has yet to be given a bill number, is being introduced by Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski. He's a member of the Senate majority, and he says the struggle to find jobs for veterans was a message he heard across Alaska.
We had a veterans summit up in Fairbanks. We had a veterans town hall meeting in Anchorage. And just in meeting with veterans groups and speaking with veterans, one of the big problems that you do hear about is employment. And we basically helping to reintegrate veterans into the job scene when they get out of them, when they finish their service. It's a big problem. It's bigger than most people realize. And if the numbers really bear it out. The unemployment rates for veterans are much higher than for non-veterans, particularly people coming out of the the current wars that we're fighting right now.
Under Senator Wilikowski's proposed bill, Alaska employers who hire a veteran full-time would be eligible for a $2,000 tax credit.
What it does is if you hire a veteran and they work for you full-time, it's 1,560 hours over a 12-month period, then the employer would get a $2,000 tax credit off of their state corporate income tax. And this is trying to incentivize businesses to go ahead and hire veterans.
Senator Bill Wilikowski is a member of the Senate Bipartisan Working Group, and he's the co-chair of the Armed Services Committee. Wilikowski anticipates his bill will be sent to the Senate State Affairs Committee that he co-chairs.
I do think this is a bill that would have broad bipartisan support. I think the legislature has been good about supporting veterans and veteran issues.
The exact economic impact of Senator Wilikowski's bill is unknown. He confirms that a fiscal note will be put together once the bill is officially introduced. The Alaska legislature is scheduled to go back into session January the 17th in Juneau. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
An icon of pioneer aviation in Northwest Arctic Alaska has been laid to rest. Marge Baker of Baker Aviation died while on vacation with her family in Mexico on December 24th. She was 79 years old. Marge was born November 30th, 1932 in Kotzebue after her parents traveled by dog team from Selawik to Kotzebue for her birth. Her parents, Lewis and Clara Rotman, ran Rotman's store in Selawik and Kotzebue. Marge attended boarding school in Seattle, and in 1957 she married Robert Bob Baker. They made their home in Kotzebue and together started Baker Aviation in 1964. 4 years later, Bob Baker was killed in an aviation accident, leaving Marge to raise seven children on her own. Although the Baker family declined to comment after her death, Marge's son, 2011 Iditarod winner John Baker, spoke more about his mom than himself during the Alaska Federation of Natives convention last fall. Baker recounted to the AFN audience that he was 6 years old when his father died.
Never once did my mother exhibit being a victim of circumstances. She faced each challenge with dignity, humility, and a can-do attitude. My mother raised each of us to be independent, hardworking, and creative problem solvers.
Baker went on to highlight her extraordinary work as not only a widowed mom of seven, but also the first woman in Alaska to own an airline.
For two decades, she was the only woman in Alaska who owned and operated her own air taxi. She was eventually joined by her friend Rita Scholten with Northern Air Cargo, and they made aviation history while providing an important service to the people in our rural communities.
John Baker said he found out his mom, Marge, had cancer on the same day he won the Iditarod. Marge was on the board of the Alaska Air Carriers Association. She was the Kotzebue station manager for Alaska Airlines and also served on the Nana Regional Corporation Board of Directors. Northwest Arctic people remember her as a woman who cared deeply for those Baker Aviation served. One former Kotzebue resident recalled sending gallons of berries from Shungnak to the Kotzebue Senior Center free of charge on one of Baker Aviation's planes, saying that kind of quiet assistance to others was a hallmark of Marge Baker's personality.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Providence Health and Services Alaska and North Rim Bank.
The state of Alaska is planning to sign a contract with a Boston-based firm to help design a health insurance exchange. An exchange is a marketplace for coverage options. Under the federal health care law, the government could step in and establish exchanges in states where none exist. Governor Sean Parnell, who is challenging the constitutionality of the law, last year refused federal funds for an exchange. The state's moving ahead now on its own. Josh Appleby, Deputy Director for Healthcare Policy for Alaska's Health Department, says states have until next January to certify that they're able to establish an exchange. The state plans to sign a contract with Public Consulting Group to evaluate such things as the cost of the exchange and its impact on the market. Residents opposed to the development of a coal mine near Sutton have filed a citizen's complaint with the Department of Natural Resources. The letter was brought to DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan's office in late November, claiming that Usabelli Coal Mine, which is engaged in coal exploration activities at Wishbone Hill, has not been operating with a valid permit. Jamie Duhamel is a spokesperson for the Mat Valley Coalition, which opposes the mine at Wishbone Hill. Duhamel says the letter was filed by the legal firm Trustees for Alaska on behalf of the members of the Mat Valley Coalition. Duhamel says the complaint has caught the attention of the Federal Office of Surface Mining.
The citizen complaint letter alleges that the permit process was not appropriately followed after 1996. DNR responded to that initial citizen complaint letter claiming that they had followed proper procedure. The citizen complaint letter was then sent to the Office of Surface Mining, which is a federal agency that oversees the Alaska Department of Natural Resources coal mine projects. And they've given DNR 10 days in which to respond to this.
DNR's coal program manager, Russell Kirkham, says that his department has until January 6th to reply to the OCS request. Duhamel says property owners are committed to protecting the value of homes near the mine. The issue of coal has been a contentious one so far, with some residents fearing health impacts from coal mining, while others support the mine plan because of economic benefit to the community. The Discovery Channel, which is already home to Alaska-based shows like Gold Rush Alaska and, of course, Deadliest Catch, debuted a new Alaska reality show last week, this one set in the outskirts of Homer. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
On Alaska's southern coast, along the rugged Kenai Peninsula, the Kilcher family settled 80 years ago in order to find a more free and simple way of life.
So begins the Discovery Channel's latest foray into Alaska-based reality TV. Alaska, The Last Frontier premiered Thursday night. The hour-long show focuses on Homer's best-known family, the Kilcher clan, many of whom still live on the 600-plus acre spread out East End Road that Patriarch Yule Kilcher first homesteaded during World War II. The shooting of Alaska, The Last Frontier took place in the fall of 2010 and the spring of 2011. Otto Kilcher hadn't seen any of the edited footage before Thursday's premiere, and he was a little bit worried about it. He said that during the filming, the Discovery Channel crew pretty much just followed family members around as they went about their daily lives, but they did occasionally try to script scenes.
They were hopeful that they would see us, gnawing on half raw coyote legs, I suppose. We pretty much just tried not to embellish it much at all. And they would ask us to say things, and I just told them I wasn't getting paid as an actor, and I wouldn't do it.
Otto Kilcher says he enjoyed working with the crew members for the most part, but working with them and trying to work around them wasn't without its drawbacks.
If they wanted to film me doing the chores, which would take me 45 minutes to an hour, by the time they showed up, by the time they mic'd you up, by the time they got all their guys together, by the time they got all their cameras together, and then filmed you, and then wanted to watch you rolling the hay bale out again because somebody didn't get the shot just right, it turned into the chores taking 3 hours.
They really do try to work with you and stay out of the way, but at the same time, they're trying to get their angle and get their shot. We went out bear hunting once, and they stayed pretty quiet and stuff for the most part, but they all of a sudden some guy will run full speed in front of you to get in ahead of you to get a shot and go crashing through the forest and making so much noise. It's like, well, there ain't nothing around here anymore. That's okay. I can just look like a failure. It'll be fine.
That's Otz Lee Kilcher, nephew of Otto and son of Otz Sr. Both Otzes are featured prominently in the show, along with Otto's son Ivan, his wife Eve, Otto's wife Charlotte and Otsley's wife Jane Kilcher. Otsley says Jane was understanding about the whole thing and even fought to have more Kilcher women included in the somewhat male-dominated show, but she was glad when the intrusion into their lives was finally over.
You know, there was days where we'd wake up to them at our house, like coming in the door, you know, and we're in bed, and they'd come up the stairs with a camera. We want to get you getting out of bed today. And she says, you know, it's kind of an invasion of privacy for sure. So that part, I think, was a bit difficult for her, but, you know, she took it all pretty well.
Almost everyone in the Kilcher family, including Otz, Otsley, and Jane, are prolific musicians. The family is well known throughout Alaska and beyond for their musical tradition. They did produce Otsley's famous sister, Jewel, after all. But Otsley says not only were the Discovery people not really interested in bringing Jewel into the show, they really weren't focused on the family's music either. Like his uncle Otto, Otsley had not had a preview of the final edited material, and he couldn't help but be a little nervous about that.
You don't know how they're going to portray you, which was kind of everyone's fear while it was being filmed. But while it was being filmed, that was kind of the most forward about it and trying to tell people, like, hey, look, let's give them a show. We got to give, you know, let's give them as much material as we can to work off of. Let's, you know, be enthusiastic, stretch the truth where necessary, you know, work extra hard. You know, push ourselves. And now I'm just worried if all of that is going to get turned into a weapon of mass destruction used against my own self.
You can get a look at the show yourself when Alaska The Last Frontier airs again this Thursday at 9 p.m. on the Discovery Channel. Here's a little preview of the second episode entitled Fueling the Fire.
While Otsley continues to search for meat, Otto has secured his own. In death, the prized milk cow has given the family much-needed protein to survive the winter.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Tom Bonsi in Oregon, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Aaron Selbig in Homer. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.